Ladies and gentlemen, we'll now open the April 8, 2011 meeting of the House Committee on Health Care. Welcome to you all. Question is what you're doing here on a Friday afternoon when it's sunny, but we'll work that out in time. Okay, first up today is we have an order of business on House Bill 2390, and this is going to be very quick. We're going to move that bill from this committee to the Joint Special Committee on Healthcare Transformation to be a vehicle bill over there. So it's procedural. It looks like we're doing something we probably ought not do, but it actually makes sense in retrospect. So do we have a motion on
this? Well, you need to open a work session.
Oh, that's right. Sorry. Well, so we'll open a work session on House Bill 2390.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2390 without recommendation to the Joint Special Committee on Healthcare Transformation.
Okay, Representative Kenneber has moved House Bill 2390 without recommendation to the Special Committee on Healthcare Transformation.
Mr. Chair, I have a 40-minute speech on this. Would you like me to deliver
it? No, it would be a good idea. But I'm going to ask if you have that written out, could you submit it to us in writing? Yeah, other than that.
Yeah, could you do a video on it, too, for those of us that are impaired?
I'm not even going to ask on this particular motion, does anybody care, because it's more serious than that. But any discussion on the motion? Hearing none.
Yes.
Representative Parrish? Excuse.
Boyle? Aye.
Representative
Whitener?
Yes.
Aye.
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 Aye. Okay. House Bill 2390 is therefore moved to the Joint Special Committee on Healthcare Transformation. And something very good is going to happen there.
One hope.
Right. So we'll close the work session on House Bill 2390 and open a hearing work session on House Bill 3028. Well, we've really got a bunch of them today, don't we? Mm-hmm. On this bill, we're not going to hear this bill at this time. But here's what we are going to do. I'm going to staple this to the wall of my office, and I'm going to ask that the insurance companies get together with the mental health nurse practitioners and see if they can find the middle ground that seems to be missing. If that can happen between now and the next session in February, I will be able to pull that bill down from my wall and ask Representative Greenlick to pull it down from his wall, and it will be over. If we don't find some way to work out the differences, I expect there will be a bill back next session on this subject. I realize it's a very difficult subject. The issue of parity crosses all areas of health care provision and insurance regulation, but in this particular case, I'm hoping we can avoid having to take a real statutory stand on this if we can work out another way. So that being the general understanding at the moment, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 3028 and wish everybody the best of luck. Okay,
Mr. Chair, we suspend the rules to allow Representative Parrish to vote on House Bill 2390?
We absolutely can. We're moving that bill from here to the Joint Special Committee on Transformation as a vehicle.
Without recommendation.
Without recommendation.
Careful, it's a hot political one.
Yeah.
Okay. That's all right, then I will vote a yes on that.
Representative Parrish.
Yes.
Thank you, Representative Widener. Okay, we'll now open a work session on House Bill 2401. You want to give us the details on that? That's the one we're moving to. Okay. I will close the work session on 2401 because I screwed up. We are not going to hear that bill today because there are some other issues with it. It may come back at a later time, but late breaking news that has prevented us from moving that. Okay, number
take five and go to this.
Okay.
Oh, Colleen, you can announce to carry this over.
Okay. Okay. We'll open, I guess I should have to announce on this one, right?
Yeah.
We're going to carry over House Bill 2371 because we don't yet have a fiscal on that one. So you'll be seeing that coming back on the 11 o'clock news or whatever. Boy, you know, we're doing really covered here.
They're doing really good.
And nobody's having to take a bad vote or anything.
I'm liking Friday afternoon. It's too early to say that.
Keep it up.
Okay, the next bill up. Here we go. House Bill, open a work session on House Bill 3523. I'm going to allow one invited guest for a minute on this bill because I assured that person that they could testify last time, and then after I assured them, I didn't let them do it, which is angle over me. So,
actually,
Megan,
I think I was the one that screwed that up.
Or whatever. But
yeah, it was
would
me.
You like to come forward and... You have about a minute.
Co-Chair Thompson, Co-Chair Representative Greenlick, members of the committee, thank you so much for this opportunity to testify in opposition of this bill. My name is Megan Cahey. I'm the president of Mental Health America of Oregon, which is a mental health advocacy organization. I'm a person who has serious mental health issues, and I've had them for 35 years of my life. I am very opposed to this bill. I think this is a parity issue, and I come at this as someone who has suffered prejudice and discrimination because of my mental health issues. We don't have special providers for people with serious diseases like cancer or heart disease or diabetes. Why should we have a special group of prescribers for a serious mental illness, which is a very serious disease, I assure you, and it's very complex. It has a lot of chronicities and comorbidities. So we need experts, and I'm very hopeful that with the healthcare transformation work that is being initiated by Representative Thompson and others, that with the community care organizations and better integration of care, that there'll be more opportunities for people to get the care they need. Thank you so much for allowing me to testify.
Thank you for your testimony.
Can I ask a question, Mr. Chair?
Please.
You feel discriminated against a lot. Are you willing to discriminate against other people with mental illness who would like to have access to a psychologist with prescribing privileges?
You know, I act as an advocate, and I take this very, very seriously. And I will advocate for people to get the care they need. Unfortunately, people with mental health issues oftentimes don't have voice, and they settle for care that is below what it should be.
I was asking if you were willing to be the voice for them, if that's what they wanted.
I would love to talk with them because I think people are misinformed, and also people are willing to settle when probably they should be proud.
You'd want to tell them they were wrong if that was what they wanted.
I would love to engage them in discussion.
And that's what you like being advocated for?
I love people to engage me with discussion, yes.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Any other discussion? Thank you, Megan.
Thank you very much.
Any other discussion on this bill?
Just a comment. You know, I think as we've talked about this issue, we realize there are a shortage of qualified people to provide medical supervision when appropriate to individuals in Oregon. And And we also have had some serious discussions that there are issues with providers who are not specialists in the field providing medication that is often inappropriate. I think you have licensed people who are trained mental health experts with a very substantial background in science and psychology, and they will have extensive additional master's level training and extensive supervised experience. I think they will provide a wonderful opportunity and a balance, and frankly, as we've also discussed, there's an enormous shortage of psychiatrists available. And I'll spare you lots of personal stories that I could tell you of my patients and some of the situations that I've seen. And while my career is over, I wish that I were a younger man for several reasons. And one of them would be I'd like to, I think I would have been able to have done a better job. And I think I did a darn good job, but I think it would have been better because it's not always easy to work with non-specialists. So I think that's probably what I have to say. Thank you. And I appreciate the opportunity to make those comments. And I think these people will serve Oregonians very well. I do believe firmly this is absolutely in the best interest of Oregonians. That's my view. And I appreciate the opportunity to say so.
Thank you. You always have the opportunity to say so. Representative Kenner.
Whoops.
Representative Widener?
Widener, I'm sorry. I was looking at you and
the other guy.
Yeah.
I can't prescribe, so I can't help that problem.
It's sure. It's been that way all day, you know, so it's only going to get worse as the day goes on.
There's some dash ones, it looks like, on 3523 here.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just wondering who brought those forward, and I'm looking at the fiscal that is on them and where these came from.
Mr. Chair, it came from the proponents of the bill. It was language that inadvertently got left out in the original drafting, and so they just wanted to include this in. So it was the proponents.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, would it be appropriate to have Dr. Henderson come and explain those?
Actually, that would. I was just given the title of Mr. Chair, so.
Mr. Chair. It's that kind of day. Don't worry about it. That's fine. We want to make sure we have it right.
Would you like Dr. Henderson to come and explain the Dash 1 amendments?
Chair Thompson and Co-Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, thank you. My name is Dr. Robin Henderson, and I represent the Oregon Psychological Association. The Dash 1 amendments, yes, indeed, are the piece of amendment that we were asked to add in 2010 that provides for liability protection for the practitioners who consult with prescribing psychologists. It was truly our mistake. We left it out of the drafting process, and we wanted to put that back in so that anybody who does consult with a psychologist would not be subject to liability.
Okay. It's sort of boilerplate language. Is that a fair way to describe that?
Yes, indeed. It is the same language we had in 2010. It just simply was an inadvertent mistake on my part. So I apologize.
Okay. Discussion. So we didn't have was there a fiscal without these dash ones on this bill? Or
there was a fiscal last time we ran this bill, a session ago. So it might be.
Just wondering, with this bill without the dash ones, with the dash ones, is there a fiscal without them? Because there obviously is fiscal with them.
There would be fiscal on the original. It just is slightly different with the dash ones.
Okay.
And we've been instructed that this, a Ways and Means referral, will be added to the bill.
Okay. I'm good.
Anyone else?
Mr. Chair, ready for a motion?
I think we're ready for a motion.
Mr. Chair, I would move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated 3-17-11.
Representative Kennemer has moved to adopt the Dash 3 Dash 1 amendments dated 3-17-11. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, the Dash 1 amendments are adopted.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 3523 as amended with the Dash 1 amendments to the floor with the due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Representative Kenemer has moved that House Bill 3523 with a Dash 1 amendments is amended. We move to the floor with a due pass recommendation and be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Any further discussion on the bill?
I guess this comes back to my fiscal responsibility discussion that we've had in here lots of times. This one is a fairly low fiscal on it, but I have a feeling it looks like it might be big enough that this bill very well could be dying in Ways and Means. So with that on the record, unless
Chair,
somebody's talked with the Ways and Means Committee.
If I may comment, a couple of things. One is, first of all, these fiscals are usually covered by fees, so this is not a general fund expenditure. Secondly, I believe, am I not correct on that?
No,
I didn't get to see the fiscal, but
yes, there is.
It's other funds.
It's other funds, yes. And secondly, I guess, and this is not the place to have that battle, but I do think this constitutes a ridiculous fiscal. In my view, and I just state my opinion, it's an example of agencies and boards making public policy. But there will be a different venue in which to address that. I think people ought to put what they have to say out there, and if that's what they wish to claim as the fiscal, then let's have a discussion in the appropriate place, which is Ways and Means.
I would agree with you that we've seen other fiscals that are questionable. Representative Parrish.
Okay. We're to the bill right now, right?
Yes.
Okay. I have really wrestled with this. This is probably the hardest, one of the hardest bills I've personally kind of contended with, and I went crashed on the couch in Representative Kinnemer's office and shared with him my concerns around kids, and I still can't get that out of my head, the notion of taking that out of the hands of my pediatrician, and so I'd love to see kids pulled out of this, and I could get there all day long, but I know. There's not a desire to amend it, so I am going to be a no today, and I know it has the votes to move forward, so I'm not going to make a big deal about it, but it's still a concern for me, and I just can't get there from here, so I just wanted to...
Representative Doherty?
Yes, I guess I just prompted a question. This is a voluntary action on the part of psychologists, is it not?
Mr. Chair, if I may respond.
You may.
Yes. First of all, you must be a licensed psychologist to begin to qualify for this. Plus, if I remember correctly, you must have been in practice for a minimum of 2 years. And then you must complete master's level 2-year additional training program, plus this essentially a year of supervised residential experience as a provider under medical supervision. So it's 3 years of additional work. The average psychologist has a minimum, the average, that's not the right, psychologists typically have a minimum of 5 years postgraduate training. So this will be 8 years of postgraduate training. I think it's a very substantial amount of training. And then they have several obligations as ethical providers. They must not do things that they are not competent to do. And, of course, consumers have the choice to not go there or, for example, to work with a psychologist and a pediatrician or whomever they wish. I think there are safeguards in this bill that protect the public.
Okay.
And we've seen it work successfully in two other states thus far.
Thank you for your answer.
Thank you.
Representative Greenlick, do you want to go last?
Yes.
Representative Cannon.
Representative Cannon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I, like Representative Parrish, have struggled with this bill. Unlike Representative Parrish, I think I've been struggling with this bill for 4 years since we heard a version of it in 2007 and then again in 2009. It is a better proposal today than when I first came upon it on this health care committee, and yet I'm not quite comfortable enough to be a yes on it. I do want to express my appreciation for what I think are the very best intentions of its proponents. And I also want to express the fact that the world will continue to turn with the passage of this bill. I don't think this will bring about some sort of disaster in Oregon's healthcare system for children or anyone else. But there are enough red flags have been raised, including from some psychologists, from obviously physicians and others, for me not to feel comfortable wading into this very difficult and important issue. And it's like other scope of practice issue, and I've expressed this in the past before too. This committee ultimately does have quite a bit of jurisdiction over scope of practice. I wish we had a better process for dealing with them. And I hearken back to the proposal from Senator Mona Sanderson. I don't think we have it this session, but to establish a committee that would advise the legislature, a committee of physicians and other practitioners to advise the legislature on these issues, that might help. I'm not comfortable supporting this today.
Representative Greenlight.
Yeah, I strongly support this proposal. I was opposed in 2007, supported again in 2009, and I support it now. It did, in fact, go through that process, Representative Cannon. The committee was named by Senator Miles Anderson. The committee worked on creating the educational standards. In fact, there was a committee before that that Representative Kotek chaired dealing with this. I think we've improved the process significantly in this. I think it is it would be, if we pass it, a modest step forward, not a giant step forward. I think you were saying that, but it seems to me psychologists, I once sat on the board of trustees of the Oregon training program for clinical psychology, something like that. It's now at Pacific University. But I'm convinced these psychologists are properly trained for dealing with psychopathology, that nobody would be forced to use the psychologist that has the ability to prescribe drugs, but if they chose to use one, it seems to me it's an option that patients ought to be able to choose, and I would urge us to move this bill to Ways and Means and to move it beyond Ways and Means if that's possible.
Any further discussion on this bill? I'm not going to ask if anybody wants to move for a unanimous vote, because that's obviously not going to happen. Okay, are we ready for the vote?
Mm-hmm.
Please call the roll.
Representative Jordan?
Yes.
Representative Parrish?
No.
Representative Boyle?
Yes.
Representative
Wagner? Aye.
Co-Chair Kenneman?
No.
Co-Vice
Chair Kenneman?
Aye.
Co-Chair Greenlight?
Aye.
Co-Chair Thompson?
No.
Boy, that's certainly a nonpartisan vote, isn't it? That's really a vote on substance. That's very good.
Doesn't that sort of parallel the discussions we've had? It's not an easy bill.
No. Did it pass?
Yes, it did pass.
Oh,
yes.
Good.
Okay, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2535-23. And we will move on. We've had a lot of different things today.
To the public hearing.
Let's now open a public hearing on House Bill 2224.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2224, chief sponsor is Representative Mitch Greenlich. It's requiring entities to report annually on system safeguards for protecting confidentiality or individual identifiable health information. This has a sunset of January 2, 2014 on the bill. And I believe you have some written testimony submitted from the hospital associations in your packet or on the S drive also for part of your information.
Co-Chair Greenlich, would you like to testify on this bill?
I would, Mr. Chair. I'm Mitch Greenlich, House District 33, Northwest Portland, West to North Plains, and I appreciate you having an opportunity to hear this bill, and I'll urge you to even consider working it when we're done. In before the 2009 session, maybe before the 2007 session, there was a major breach at Providence Health in systems, and there were several thousand confidential medical records that disappeared because the system for safeguarding those records was somebody takes a laptop home at the end of the day and leaves it in their car overnight, so it can't be so that it doesn't disappear in case of a fire or something else. Well, somebody stole the computer, and of course all Providence did a very responsible job in responding. I mean, they responded quickly, openly. They did everything they could to mitigate it, but basically it was, gee, some dummy down in information services really didn't have a very good system, and I'm sure somebody got fired over that, but it wasn't the CEO. And that struck me to bring this bill forward that requires for specific healthcare organizations, basically hospitals and health insurance plans, bring this forward, a sort of Sarbanes-Oxley kind of bill that requires the CEO to certify each year that they reviewed the privacy safeguard systems, say it's okay, looked over what happened in the past year, and reports not publicly but to their auditors and their board any breaches in the prior year, any things they see as shortcomings in the system, and gets them to take seriously their CEO responsibility to safeguard patient data. This isn't about blaming. It's about getting people seriously responsible for understanding safeguarding our private data really matters. In the 2007 legislature, we passed something called the Oregon Consumer Identity Theft Protection Act, and that requires insurers to notify affected customers in the most expeditious time possible and without unreasonable delay. When we passed this bill out of the House, it went to the Senate, and the Senate argued, well, they had already done it, and it wasn't an issue because of the Consumer Identity Theft Protection Act, and it went to a conference committee where it died in that committee. Well, we thought the problem was solved. On January 21st, in 2011, HealthNet lost 9 data servers from its Sacramento office, whatever that means. The servers contained the personal information of 1.9 million customers nationwide and included names, addresses, social security numbers, and financial records of those people. Almost 2 months passed before customers were notified of the breach. In cases of possible identity theft, a timely response is critical. Customers were not alerted to the breach until March 14th, more than 2 months later, even though the Oregon Insurance Division was made aware of the issue in late February. OID claimed it took them that long to confirm the identities of the affected customers. HIPAA rules require insurers to make every reasonable effort to notify affected customers as quickly as possible. DCBS has begun this investigation. Now, you're going to hear from hospitals that modern society, as we know it, will come to an end if their CEOs need to take responsibility for their own data. I think we as citizens have a right to ask them to be certifying the extent to which they understand what's going on, the extent to which they ask what's going on, the extent to which they find shortcomings in their data system, and to which they report them to their bosses, not to the world, not to the insurance division, not to OHA, but to their own bosses, their auditors and their boards of directors. And I really think it is time to do this. I'd like to try and get it out of the House again and see if I can work with the Senate to make sure it's something that they want. But I think this is an important, modest little addition to the Oregon Consumer Identity Theft Protection Act of 2007. Mr. Chair, I hope you'll act on this and send it to the floor.
Are there any questions or discussion? I guess you did an excellent job.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Answered everyone's questions.
Thank you.
And Next, we will call Mr. Drew Hagedorn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. Drew Hagedorn appearing today on behalf of the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. I'm appearing before Andy Easton, who couldn't be here today. It's our understanding that the bill's principal policy objective is to ensure hospital CEOs and boards are engaged in protecting the security of patient records, and we applaud that ambition, and we believe that we're already taking active steps to do so. We, however, respectfully would oppose this proposal because we believe it's redundant. And I'll explain four situations or four laws since the incident that was referenced by Chair Greenlick. In 2007, the Oregon Legislative Assembly passed Senate Bill 583. That bill required hospitals and others to adopt regulations to apply significant security measures protecting patient information. Second, current HIPAA security regulations also require thorough administrative and technical procedures to secure records. Third, as of August 2009, hospitals and others that maintain patient accounts are required to comply with what are known as red flag rules, and that requires them to adopt policies and procedures to identify red flags for identity theft. Significantly, the hospital must involve its management at the highest levels in the development of these policies and procedures. Finally, we now have federal regulations known as HITECH that enact far-reaching changes to the HIPAA privacy and security laws, including expanded requirements related to accounting for disclosures and requirements to notify patients if a breach occurs. So it's our view that there are already existing laws, both at the federal and state level, that address this issue, and we would respectfully ask you to oppose House Bill 2224.
Representative Doherty.
Thank you. Mr. Hagedorn, I'm not familiar with the board structure that they have in the hospitals, but do hospital boards, is part of their responsibility to review and approve policies that are written by the management of the hospital?
Co-chairs, Representative Doherty, I don't know that I can answer that question specifically. I would guess that it depends on the hospital's board process and its guiding principles and articles of incorporation, et cetera.
Could I get that information? And the reason is just I would assume that with any sort of board that kind of the buck stops with them. And so I just didn't know if they had any authority or even knew that whether there were policies around. So if we get that information, I'd really
be happy to do so. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
You may ask Mr. Hagedorn.
Absolutely.
Please, I don't want to beat up on you. I'd be happy to beat Andy. But this bill is a huge problem, right? It requires a CEO to sign a form once a year. Now, are they trying to hide something? I mean, what's wrong with them signing a form? Even if there are 15 bills that are in place, this asks them to sign a form once a year that say, we know what's going on, and if there have been any problems, we've reported to the board. That's all it does, right? Is that, you recognize that?
Co-chairs, I think my perspective of Section 3 on page 3, starting at line 1, is that it does require effectively a CEO to file what amounts to an affidavit with the Oregon Health Policy and the Office of Oregon Health Policy and Research. It doesn't direct that anything be done with that from there, so that perplexes us somewhat. Further, I believe it may subject CEOs to potentially civil liability. At lines 11 through 17, there are some, what I would describe anyway, as ambiguous standards. Significant deficiency isn't defined in that capital A subsection on line 11.
Which page, please?
Page 3, line 11. Further on line 15, the material or not. So you have the definition of significant and then the definition of material or not, I would say, are ambiguous, and that's probably something that a court would have to address if somebody, got themselves in a situation where they were suggesting that they didn't comply with the bill.
You're kidding, right? I mean, is that a serious comment? The question says you should report it whether it's material or it isn't material. Is ambiguous? What's ambiguous about that?
The definition of material.
Yeah, but it says it doesn't matter whether it's material or not. You should still report it.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome. Any other discussion? Okay, with that, I guess we will close the work session. Close the public hearing, I'm sorry. I'll get this straightened out by the end of the session. On House Bill 2224. And I imagine we'll be hearing about this bill again.
Only if you carry it over.
Are we not going to move to a work session?
You want to move to it?
Are you okay?
It's ready to go.
Sure. Okay.
We're going to wait on it a little bit.
What are we doing?
You'd like to wait on it?
Do we want to work this bill today?
I really would like to get that information. And the reason I asked Mr. Hagendorf for this is it's one thing, you know, if the idea to have the CEO sign and do all of this kind of stuff, but it's also the responsibility of a board of directors of any organization to know what's going on. And so I just didn't know also what, if they were introduced to this, really what their liability was. In other words, if there's a breach in security and a board of directors of a hospital or any organization has gone through and approved the process that was presented to us as to what things are, you know, what safeguards we have, I think it's important that the board also has some responsibility in this. And he didn't have the answer, so.
Well, chief executive officer, if I may, Mr. Chair.
No, please.
Chief executive officer means they're in charge of the operation of it. And this requires that if they have a problem, they report to the board. The board generally doesn't approve operating procedures, at least in the organizations I'm familiar with.
And so we're hoping that the CEO informs the board.
Requires the CEO to inform the board of any breaches or any shortcomings that he or she perceives.
What about any sort of procedure and policy in place? Does the board see that ahead of time, or is that the CEO's responsibility?
Well, my problem is it's not been the CEO's responsibility. My problem is that most organizations, procedures work their way up the chain, and that this might be the head of the IT or something else that's responsible for this. What I'm trying to do is to bring the CEO into the question when it relates to the safeguarding of personal information. So what I'm hoping this through, in order to sign that affidavit, it seems to me that a CEO needs to find out what's going on and be prepared. If he or she is going to put their name on the line by saying, I've reviewed these procedures, I feel they're safe, and I have also informed my board if there's any problems, it seems to me that simply raises it to a little higher level, and that's where I think it should be. Some poor data processing guy gets fired every time one of these breaches happen, and it's because the CEO stands up and has a press conference and says, God, this is terrible. We're trying to find out who's responsible, and we're going to get them. And they're responsible, it seems to me. So that's all this is trying to do, is to elevate that sense of responsibility to the chief executive of an organization. Now, they may not want to do this. They may be afraid if they sign something and they haven't really done their homework, then and there's a breach, then they might be liable. Maybe they would be, because they had signed a document that said they've done something, and if they haven't done it, that could produce liability. But here's hundreds of thousands of records keep disappearing out of these health organizations.
Let's hold this over till Monday and make sure everybody's okay.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Because the one question I did have, and so the intent of what you believe this language is that it's got the CEO is the board in absentia, I guess, that if the CEO is responsible for the board's actions. And so if they don't...
For his organization's action, not for the board's action. CEO reports to the board.
My one thing is, it just seems to me that the board also needs some responsibility, too, and I realize that's not in there. So if I just have that answer, that question answered, I'd feel more comfortable.
Okay, we'll schedule it for a work session on Monday, April 11th. Possible work session, I'm sorry. I haven't seen the schedule for Monday, but...
You said it for a work session?
It's about a possible work session. You'll have the gavel on Monday. Okay?
Thank you.
Everybody feel comfortable with that?
Actually, could we consider Wednesday to give us just a little more time to look into this?
Because
I actually have some serious concerns with this, too, because a CEO is not necessarily an IT person, and you can have an IT person tell you, oh, we're great, we're all protected and everything else. And so there's a lot of issues that are involved with this. So, but I understand I'm with Representative Greenlick and his concerns on this, and it's a much larger picture. And I don't know, I think we need to set some guidelines maybe in place that they must be following and sign off that they are following
those
guidelines.
If there's no objection, can we hold this over for a possible work session on Wednesday? It should give everyone adequate time.
Can we do that?
Yeah. To answer the questions.
Hold over for a work session. You don't have to. You don't have to open the meeting. Right. But not possible.
I think everything's possible, isn't it?
Well, you can hold it over for.
Okay, we'll hold it for a work session. Okay.
And then not open.
Work session on Wednesday.
I would just ask my colleagues to. It's a very short bill. To take a look and read it. If there are questions, let's talk about it. I'd be happy. Thank you, sir.
Okay. Possible work session on or a work session on Wednesday. I'm tripping over my own words again. Okay. And that will be April 13th.
Correct.
Okay. Jeez. Close the public hearing then on House Bill 2224 and continue the excitement on Wednesday. I think that leaves us with about two things left. So let's open a work session on House Bill 2100 that it appears that that excitement has been holding a lot of you here. So, okay, work session open on House Bill 2100. And the invited testimony will be from Jim Gardner, Dr. Janine Smith, and Tom Burns. While they're coming up, I'd just like to make the statement that I am really, really pleased and relieved at how well this group came together on the work sessions on this bill. We had a number of sessions with a lot of people, agency and outside people, on a very contentious, long list of issues, and no one left any meeting or at the end bloodied. So everything worked exactly the way it was supposed to work, and we got a much better bill out of it. So, again, my congratulations to the work group for the fine job you all did. Is Dr. Smith here? Or
Mr. Chair, we are looking for her.
Okay.
In the meantime, we have a two-part tag team, so I'll go first.
Hey, two-step. Go for it.
Co-chairs and members, I'm Tom Burns, Director of Pharmacy Programs for the Oregon Health Authority. We are here to say thanks to the work group because it really was a well-done work group. When you passed House Bill 2009 2 years ago, you asked that the health authority come up with a statewide drug formulary. Unfortunately, there was no mechanism to do that. We looked around at what was going on out there in the commercial world as well as in other states, and came up with the idea of a pharmacy and therapeutics committee. We wanted the committee to be transparent. We wanted the committee to have public involvement. We wanted the committee to be able to work expeditiously and be able to bring in medical experts when the committee felt that it did not have the ability to resolve an issue on their own. The problem, the working with pharma addressed a number of concerns that they had. We agreed with those concerns, and we now have a proposal in front of you in the form of the DASH 4 amendments that expand the committee to 11 persons. It will continue to be appointed by the director of OHA. We will continue to have the OSU School of Pharmacy be the staff of the committee. As I said, they can bring in experts and will function a P&T committee just like the commercial markets do. Pharma identified a number of issues that I think made the bill better. First of all, when the original bill was brought before you, it sunsetted the preferred drug list program in the state, and that was a mistake. We've clarified how medical experts will be added to the committee. We require that the committee's decisions to be posted 60 days before they go into effect, which will allow the doctors and the consumers, the clients for the Medicaid program, to be aware of any changes in their drug regimen. We've made the decisions clear that it will be done on safety and efficacy first, and only if there is no difference in that will we look at any kind of substantial cost differences. We've assured that there will be notification to the public 30 days in advance of the committee meeting, and we have clarified that there will be only one group in the government that will be looking at the review of drugs, and that is the P&T committee, that the review that used to be done by the Health Resources Commission, which is now being merged into the Health Evidence Resources Committee, will go away. So what you have in front of you is a much better bill. I want to thank Jim Gardner and Pharma for the work they did with us and the work you did, Mr. Thompson, and I would commend the bill to you.
Co-Chair Thompson and Co-Chair Greenlich. My name is Janine Smith. I'm the Administrator for the Office of Health Policy and Research in the Oregon Health Authority. And we have also been participating in this work group, and we'll touch on the section regarding the Health Evidence Review Commission. This, as noted, combines the work of the Health Resources Commission with the Health Services Commission into this new commission to continue the work that's been going on in the state for the last two decades. It's an effort to streamline and better organize the maintenance of the prioritized list of health services, as well as assuming the Health Resources Commission's work on providing unbiased technology assessments and honoring the recent discussions the Health Resources Commission has had with the industry to develop some rules around their medical technology assessments. It will also operationalize what we've actually started down, which is to develop some common evidence-based guidelines. We are partnering with those in the associated with the Oregon Quality Corporation and the Health Leadership Council around one of those right now on low back pain, and we'll continue to do that collaboratively. And some of the key aspects that have been hammered out in the amendment discussions have been finalizing the memberships of the new merged commission, and so we have outlined some of the adjustments that have been made that kind of clarify some of the roles, including the addition of a complementary and alternative medicine designated seat, and a little more clarity around the hospital designated seat. The other has been, as Tom already mentioned, to have the Health Resources Commission doing both the evidence-based drug reviews as well as the medical technology reviews. And so by having now the P&T committee fully developed, we would hand that off to them, and we would continue along medical technology reviews. So I think the goal in this amendment is really to just streamline a process that's been going on since 1989, when the original Oregon Health Plan was started, and was further clarifies some of the aspects of House Bill 2009. So with that, I will turn it over to Mr. Gardner.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner, and I'm appearing today for PhRMA, the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, which is the trade association for the large research-based drug companies. It truly is a fun thing to celebrate one of those rare moments of kumbaya, at least with regard to the clients that I represent, with the OHA here. And very, very good. Very good singing, Mr. Co-Chair. It was a good hard work, and it was a pleasure to work with these fine folks. I think that we do bring you back a bill that is better than we found, and hopefully will accomplish the objectives that that my two colleagues outlined. It, by placing the drug class review in one entity, we have done a little bit of reinvestment that should not only streamline the process, but make it more efficacious. And I do want to draw your attention to one small element that is in the bill, which is on page 5, lines 3 through 4. This is language that's borrowed from recent federal legislation applicable to Medicare, and it basically says that while comparative effectiveness research is important, terribly important in terms of review of medical technology, that it's not the be-all and end-all that you need, as we always have done with respect to the prioritized list. You need to take into consideration some other factors, such as, for instance, impact on vulnerable populations, impact on populations of color, and the like. So it's just a simple safeguard that's that really echoes what we've been doing with the Health Services Commission in the developing the line.
Any questions of Representative Jordan?
Maybe just a comment. I'd like to echo Representative Thompson. In the short time I've been in the legislature, I'm very pleasantly surprised and pleased that when the parties do get together and do come up with legislation that deals with the issues, so we don't have to deal with them again in February and all of the unintended consequences. And I know it's not an easy process, and a lot of times it's really hard, but I think the end product is good, and so I also would like to echo my compliments too. And not just you, but this happens building-wide.
Mr. Chair, I would like to move the -5 amendments to House Bill 2100, and I'll explain that, why I want to do it and what it does.
Chair, that's your motion?
My motion is to adopt the -5 amendments to House Bill 2100.
Chair Greenlick has moved that we adopt the -5 amendments to House Bill 2100, dated 4-7-11.
And I've distributed those. First, let me say I am quite satisfied with the -4s and will support the bill with the -4s, but I wanted to get I wanted us to make an explicit decision on one point, and I may need to change that point. But if you look at the -4s, page 4, section 26A, the -5 deletes, it's the same except it deletes section 26A. And let me talk about why I think that's an important thing for us to decide explicitly whether we want to delete it or not.
Excuse me, I don't have that on either my computer. Thank you.
And I just downloaded it on the computer. So
did you?
You refresh, it might be in the S. Right, you have a hard copy.
We're missing some other paperwork, so we're not going to be able to move this bill today anyway, but then I do want this on the record.
And then I may propose another amendment after we have a discussion on this.
Okay.
The -5 does, it's exactly the same as the -4, except it deletes section 26A, page 4 and 5, and it does delete 1, 2, and 3 of it. I'd be happy to put 3 back if that's an issue. I carried it too far, but I did want to talk about section 1 and 2, and I know this is a sense to make sure we don't get hung up in death squad kinds of things, and I think that's a reasonable thing, and I want to support it. But I think this has some very specific problems, and let me go back to the original rankings that created the Oregon Health Plan Priority List. There were such things in that ranking when we went out to society and had a couple hundred meetings around the state. We asked people to talk about policy issues that were on their mind and what do they value in terms of implementation of this. And they valued such things as well child care as opposed to end of life care for senior citizens. Now that was a social value. Now, it seemed to me under this regulation that would not be something that we could decide to do or value something for a child, immunization for kids, higher on a list than you name it for anybody else. And I don't think we want to explicitly do that. So what I think is, and Section 1 and Section 2 of 26A really are fairly broad-reaching, not only in terms of this group, but in terms, I believe, in Dr. Smith, and correct me, I believe this will also affect work of the Health Services Commission and other, I think this would impinge in other places where we make priorities. And I think we as a society may want, I don't think we want the government to do it, I don't think we want the bad guys to do it, but I think we may, when we have to express preferences, express these kind of preferences. And I think under 21, under 26A, 1 and 2, it would prevent us from making those kind of decisions. So if we're going to put this in, I want to make sure we've done it explicitly rather than just sort of accidentally. And that's why I propose a 5. But in fact, I would be willing to even withdraw that, and if we have more time, get a dash 6. That leaves the third item in line 3, the question of not solely on the basis of a comparative effectiveness research, but these other things, it would seem to me we as a society ought to be able to do.
Do we have any comments from the panel while we still have you here?
Co-chair, the sub 3 is what that's what we care about.
Yeah, I don't have a problem putting that back.
That's what we want.
I think I inadvertently caused this problem myself by asking some very broad questions, making some very broad statements, and then leaving the room for everybody else to try to figure out what I meant. So I appreciate the fact that there was an attempt to get in what I meant. I'm not sure I knew what I meant, so I have no problem with the amendment.
Mr. Let me withdraw my motion, if I may.
Okay.
And leave it open.
The dash fives, or when we start going to that type of language, just because of personal beliefs, I would have trouble supporting them.
Supporting which of
the dash fives. So
you prefer the dash fours, is what you're saying?
Yes, the ones that we had here. The dash fives I just saw for the first time right now, but the dash fours I would support.
Any other discussion?
Let me get a dash sixes drawn, if I may, and then
we can't move the bill today anyway, so there's still some time for discussion.
I don't need a fiscal on any of them.
Okay. And then let's make this explicit in the discussion.
Anything that kind of opens the door towards what I would refer to as death panels, things like that, are things that I'm not going to support. So just for the record, and leaves it open when you start working on dash sixes or anything like that so we can have a discussion over them.
Palliative care, not death panels, palliative care.
Well, except I don't think this relates to that at all.
I go to that talk with
I think the language, I mean, this is what I was trying to do. I think you take the language out in 1 and 2 and 26A, I don't think you've opened it for anything. It's just, this stops you from doing something that I suspect with your value system you might want to be able to do. That's the...
I suspect if I hadn't said anything at all, we'd all be better off today, so, which is usually the case. Okay, I'm going to close the hearing on a work session on House Bill 2100, and we will resolve this last piece and come back. And I want to thank you people for your assistance on this in the committee, and now we'll finish the last detail. The work session is closed. Okay, do we have...
Well, 3137.
Do you want to
try to get Lori?
Yeah, should we get Lori back?
Yeah. Or do you want to start your discussion and I'll call her?
Well, let's get Lori back and finish where she was.
Stand down for a minute till we do that.
Yeah. And then,
okay. We're going to stand down for a moment while we. open a continued work session on House Bill 3137. And just a note on that, I was told today at noon that Senate Bill 99 is expected to be passed out next Wednesday.
Out of the committee or out of the...
Out of the committee.
They are hoping, as Representative Widener said, to get it from the committee to the floor to our committee, and from our committee to Ways and Means, rather than going to Ways and Means.
That's my understanding.
That's what they're going to try and
yes.
do. So we will have 99, and part of the issue will be how 3137 compares to it, and the things that Representative Kenemer and Cannon have done up till now to
right.
put those together. That's really going to be good. That is exactly what you said, isn't it?
Yeah. So with that, Lori, the show is yours.
Mr. Co-Chairs, members of the committee, Lori Freeman from Office of Legislative Counsel.
Can you slide that, Michael? Yeah, thank you.
First of all, I want to make sure to correct a misstatement I made last time I testified, and it has to do with the funding for the navigators. And I was thinking that there were federal grants available for that, but it's not true. It has to be self-sustaining. So it would be the way the bill is set up, it would come from the assessment that's imposed on the insurers, and there's not a question of federal monies involved. And I think when we left off, Representative Greenlick, you'd asked me to compare the board composition in 99-5 with the board composition in this bill. I don't think there's a difference in the composition itself.
What section is that?
Until you get down to the conflict of interest piece in section subsection 5. So in 3137, we have just a blanket prohibition on anyone with an actual conflict of interest serving as a member of the board, which would, and then in 99-5, we have specific folks who are prohibited from serving on the board. So those would be individuals who are employed by consultants to or members of a board of directors of an insurer, third-party administrator, insurance producer, healthcare provider, healthcare facility, or health clinic, or members, board members or employees of a trade association of insurers, third-party administrators, healthcare providers, healthcare facilities, or health clinics. Or healthcare providers unless they receive no compensation for rendering services as providers and do not have an ownership interest in professional healthcare practices. So the difference between the two, the major differences is by defining actual conflict of interest with by the definition that's found in ORS 244.020, you pick up relatives of people. Whereas the 99-5 doesn't refer to relatives, and it also in 3137 it would exclude a member of a board of a nonprofit organization, whereas for example a hospital or a health system, even if it was nonprofit, the board members would be excluded.
In which version?
In 99-5.
I have heard there's more acceptance to that version than this one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Which, Lori, which version is the more permissive and which is the more restrictive?
Mr. Co-Chairs, Representative Cannon, I really can't say. I mean, there are some people that are included on one and are not on the other and vice versa.
Just as a follow-up, my understanding of the, and I haven't looked at the site, but my understanding of the conflict of interest statute is that that's actually a fairly narrow. I mean, it is the conflict of interest statute doesn't cast necessarily a very wide net. That's my impression. It does include
direct conflicts of interest.
Direct, which I think is what's alluded to in the dash ones to this bill, is direct conflict of interest. And I just think we should be clear before we make this decision what the implications of that would be. I think it might be possible that the dash fives of Senate Bill 99, which appear to be, I know some advocates have said, look, you could have a couple of members from insurers, or a couple of employees of insurers, they may not have a conflict of interest as defined in the statute. Maybe that's a question. Does an employee of an insurance company have a conflict of interest under our statute?
Or would they be excluded under the other one?
Yeah, that's another way of putting it. Would they be excluded under the dash ones?
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Cannon, an employee is specifically excluded under the 99-5.
Right. What about the
Actual conflict of interest, and I apologize for not bringing it with me, but it talks to a pecuniary interest, and it seems to me that an insurer would have a pecuniary interest in, you know, I can't really tell you off the top of my head. I mean, the big difference there, I think, is this relative connection that for an actual conflict of interest, it would bring in relatives of people who have an interest or who have a business relationship. And I'm not sure that 99-5 would reach that. So, and I think I just have to go on a case-by-case basis.
But 99, this version gives you a yardstick at which to measure people, but they need to be measured against that yardstick. It sounds like the 99-5 say, not this person, not that person, not the other person. Is that what I heard you say?
Greenlick, that's correct.
So you don't have to interpret anything. It's just, I guess that's...
Representative Hoyle?
I'm sorry for asking a question that's probably... I don't know if this is a stupid question, but it's a question I have, and I'm at the dais, so I can ask it.
That's right.
What?
You're a legislator. You can ask any stupid question you want.
I know, all day long. So, on our House bill, and I should know this, where did we start? Which version of the
99-2s.
99-2s.
With my amendment to that around brokers.
Okay.
Is that right, Lori?
Why?
That's correct.
As opposed to the 99 or 99-5, why do we start at the dash 2s?
I made a call on it because when the Senate went from dash 2s to dash 3s, a lot of people thought it got worse. So I said, okay, let's start there. Then they did a dash 4, and then they did a dash 5. So we were in process while it was a moving target. We thought, let's start somewhere. But now that they've passed the fives, as you go to the floor, I think we need to be comparing what we're doing to the fives, especially if we get the fives.
Well, and that's my only concern, and I understand the dash twos to the dash threes, but with the dash five, I know that there were a number of negotiations and things that happened between the twos to the fives that we should be considering, so I don't know if we should be looking at the dash five and moving from that point or... comparing, and I know at the Senate hearing we went through sort of piece by piece, and there were a number of people that are here that weren't there, just going through, this is what the exchange bill is, this is, I thought that was very helpful. I don't know if we actually want to do that again, but I am concerned that there was a fair amount of work, and if we're starting from a certain place and moving it forward, I guess I'm not sure it wouldn't be better to start with what they did, because they did improve some things from the dash threes, although there's some places where we may have some significant differences.
I think all this is intended, all I intended to do, I wasn't sure we were going to get dash fives.
I thought
it was going to go down to ways and means, and we needed to do it.
So right.
I would suggest that that's something we need to be focusing on right now, and that Lori, and I think it's something Representative Cannon did in looking at picking out Representative Kenimer at picking out those major issues as it related first to this and the dash five. So, yeah, if it really looks like we are going to have the dash fives next week, The other thing is, if we get a Senate bill that we're working on, we have a whole different time frame.
Mm-hmm.
If we are really going to get a Senate bill, then we've got a lot more time than if we had to produce a bill to get down to Ways and Means to have two bills down there to compare to each other. So,
I'd be. Did you have a question?
I guess I was going to harken back to the earlier conversation where we were.
No, that's
fine. Are you
fine.
Finished?
That's fine.
About the discussion of potential and actual conflicts of interest. And I guess that harkens back. I'm the one who introduced that discussion when we were jointly with the Senate committee. And it comes from my bias that I think we need substantial expertise on this board, and those people will have a conflict of interest at some point. Sometimes it's a potential conflict of interest because I believe the statute identifies an actual is when you have a pecuniary or financial interest. So if your company is interested in bidding on this or providing that service at a charge, you might have an actual conflict of interest. In general, if you're talking about insurance and you're making decisions about how much brokers are reimbursed and all of these other issues that are inside of that, then you probably are under a potential conflict of interest by virtue of being an insurance executive, agent, any number of qualifiers that you could meet. And I guess I still remain of a firm opinion in order to function well, this people has to, and in such a complex environment, there have to be members who have extensive knowledge and experience, I think, more than just, you know, having a board exclusively, for example, has been suggested by some of advocates or non-experts.
Citizens.
Thank you. That's the word I was searching for.
Perhaps a suggestion to Representative Kinnemer, the dash ones that we're looking at, or the Senate bills dash twos, use this actual the prohibition is on people with an actual conflict of interest, and I would be interested in a opinion something from LC. What does that mean? I mean, I'm looking at the statute, but in terms of in insurance, the types of people who you're imagining coming onto the board, would that prohibit them or not?
Yes. Well, see, that was the point that I brought up. If you have an actual conflict of interest, and my understanding of Oregon law is you are prohibited from acting, and so they would have to withdraw from the process. Well, their comments are important to us, and we need a process to allow them to continue to be involved if they're going to be on the board.
Perhaps I misheard you, Representative Kinnemer. I thought you were distinguishing between people with an actual conflict of interest and people with a potential conflict of interest, and suggesting that the people who we want on the board would be the latter, people with a potential conflict but not an actual conflict. But I this is an area, I mean, I don't know anything about this law.
Let me give you an example that's not a good one. But, you know, we just had a hearing today on PERS and business and labor. All of us have a potential conflict of interest that are in PERS or have, by virtue of being legislators, and there are some new ones who have not opted for that, so they don't. But, you know, we're in a class, so we can usually vote on those matters. If we had an actual conflict of interest, I guess we would not. We would be on the board of directors or something of PERS. Wouldn't that constitute an actual, and we would be prohibited from voting?
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Kenner, the only difference between an actual and a potential is, in one case, you have a financial benefit or detriment, and in the other you could.
And you still can vote, though, either way, as long as you declare it.
No, in neither case can you vote.
In this case.
No, under most.
Well, in Oregon, yeah, we vote regularly. I have a potential.
This is unusual. I think legislative requirement to vote is very unusual.
Well, that's, I guess, maybe where I have confusion. Excuse me.
I just wanted to.
My concerns about this, and I think we ought to. I agree with you. I take a very close look. I can foresee a time that this board is going to want to have an insurance actuary involved. And I can't imagine finding one that isn't either contracted to a group of insurance companies or employed by one, because there's not a whole lot of reason to be an insurance actuary if you aren't making any money at it. And I would like to see a way that we can get the conflict of interest worked out where people like that can be on the board and contributing, but how do we put the fences around it without saying they may not be on the board? I would like to have the board structure be as permissive as possible to allow the right people and not find ourselves inadvertently closing the doors to expertise that we find out we really do want on the board.
Mr. Chair, I have a different model. I've had a lot of experience with nonprofit boards, and I think most of us have with those kind of boards. And nonprofit boards are structured because they can't afford to hire good staff, usually. That they'll get a banker, and they'll get an insurance person, they'll get an accountant, and they'll get somebody on the board who will end up being sort of consultants to the CEO of the organization. But in this case, we're talking about what could be a $1 billion corporation. And I don't think that's the way major corporations work. I think major corporations hire their technical expertise rather than have them as board members. And the boards are more involved with the policy oversight. I mean, I'd be very interested in knowing what the SAFE board looks like, for example, which I don't have a clue. But my guess is there's not an actuary on it. That's my guess without knowing. There's not somebody who knows something about insurance. They want actuaries, they hire 15 of them. And they want somebody who knows something about insurance, and they hire an executive from the insurance industry. I think in this case, we need to be thinking about a board, and I don't think it needs to be consumer advocates or anything else. I was purposeful when I said citizens. I think this board ought to be people who represent society at the relatively highest level. I mean, I think the governor will get a business executive. I mean, they'll get a variety of people, I would assume, on this board, and not worry about the expertise component of it, and a couple of professional advocates. I mean, I think you'll find all those people. So, I mean, I think somewhere we really do need to say, what's the name? This is going to be a very big business board, I assume. Anyway.
Yeah. Let's change the subject just a little bit. I think I'm going to pick up on something that Representative Hoyle was close to talking about.
I'm
going to put words in her mouth. Cause,
oh, goodness. You
know, not sanitary.
Here's the point at which she's really frightened. Do we need to be doing this today in light of the fact that Senate Bill 99 is right around the corner? And maybe they don't even have to pass the floor. If they pass it out of committee, we can begin looking at it, because that's kind of like the final form. The Senate's going to yes or no on it on the floor. And maybe we need to wait for the 99-5 document to pass and have something to hang a sail on.
Wanting to get to a Blazer game tonight without getting too snarled in traffic, I would certainly say that what you're proposing makes sense. I think what we need to watch for is, if it's going to go to Ways and Means rather than to floor, then I think we don't need to do it tonight, but I think we want to pass a House bill, two Ways and Means, so they're both there.
Okay.
Right.
But if it really is going to come from the committee to the floor, we'll obviously know next week, and then come to us as a Senate bill for us to consider. I think that would be great, and then we can take a deep breath.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I won't have time to work on this on Monday anyway. Representative Hoyle.
I think that's a great idea. I agree with both of you.
Very good choice. Very good position.
Mr. Chair, I would just note that the document that Representative Kenemer and I prepared, our basis for that was the dash fives from Senate Bill 99, which have passed out of committee, I believe, right? So
it's gone from the subcommittee
to the full committee. Okay, so it is the working version of Senate Bill 99. That was the basis. That was the basis for the underlying comments we made about Senate Bill 99.
That's great. So what are the druthers of the committee? Are there any druthers of the committee?
I move we adjourn.
It's a non-debatable motion.
I love it.
Aye.
Aye. Okay, I think that's probably a wise choice. I think Lori has something else to do this week, was my understanding. It'd probably be 4-5.
Lori, can we talk about the Dash 6 2100 before you go?
Yeah. Do you want to close the work session and adjourn?
I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 3137 for today. We will be continuing this. Wish everybody a great weekend, and the solution to our problems will be evident on Monday, I'm sure.
Yeah, maybe our problems.
We are therefore adjourned. Have a good weekend.